Dr. Pete, thank you so much for joining us today on Galesburg Live.
No, thanks for having me. Yeah, people regard dogs and cats as part of their family, and certainly we do at Animal Medical Center. So.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background. You're not from the Galesburg area.
No, I grew up on the in northern Illinois, close to the Wisconsin border.
Yeah.
On a small family farm type of a household, and went to high school there, and then did all my undergrad and graduate school at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. So I lived there for quite a while.
Yeah, right, right. So what have you always been interested in veterinary medicine? Is that always what you said when you're younger? That's what I'm going to be.
That's always what I said all the way up. I think I decided for sure someplace in undergrad when I had, you know, ridden with large animal vet and been in some small animal clinics long enough to decide that was definitely the route that I wanted to go.
Now, are you considered more of a general practitioner? Or do they have that in animals?
Yeah, all four of our doctors are considered general practitioners. None of us have formal specialties, although each of the four of us has things that we sort of focus on.
Sure.
And that's been very helpful for us, that we each have our own little subspecialties.
What's your specialty?
So I do orthopedics. I do all of our orthopedic surgeries, and probably 25% of the surgeries that I do now are referrals from other outlying clinics.
Okay. And the most popular, well, I won't say most popular, but the most frequent orthopedic surgery that you do for animals?
That would be knee surgery.
Oh.
Dogs very commonly hurt the one ligament in their knee, very similar to the ACL in humans.
I see. So. And is it due to age, or is it just injury in general?
Just because they're very athletically active.
Sure.
And, you know, similar to the ACL, it's injured when the body keeps going forward and the foot stays still. And if you picture a Labrador Retriever jumping up and catching a Frisbee and then hitting the ground, that's the most common type of
I see. Bigger dogs, usually?
Typically bigger dogs.
Yeah, yeah. And you have a family business here. You you practice with your wife.
Yes, my wife, Kristen, is also a veterinarian. We met in undergrad, and so she also practices at our clinic.
Yeah.
And she does all small animal. All the other three doctors do completely small animal, and I do mostly small animal with some large animal out there still too, with a farm background. I still do a little bit of dairy work and some 4-H pigs and sheep and goats.
So. Yeah, wonderful. You've worked with your wife for a long, long, long time. Is it tough to separate the home and the office and all that?
And we do fairly well with it.
Yeah.
You know, it takes a little adjusting. We've been working together now for 5 years. Yeah. Previously, we worked at different practices, but you learn how to manage that one.
Yeah, right.
As you go.
We were just talking earlier. How would you like me to refer to you? Dr. Pete is fine, and because it's. You have to have that little bit of separation. If you say Dr. Plesha, you might not know who you're.
Yeah, you could get either one of us, although my voice is a fair amount lower. So,
well, I was about to say, if this vet thing doesn't work out, you know, you could get a great job in radio because you've got that, you know, you've got that deep voice there.
I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, right. So what is, again, and you may have already said this, but your wife's specialty?
Kristen's her biggest thing is internal medicine,
okay.
So really good at dealing with metabolic diseases such as diabetes. Also, she has an interest in cancer treatment and, you know, diagnosis and treatment of cancer. So she's very handy with the microscope and looking at different cell types, and that's sort of what she focused on. And a lot of the specialty classwork that she took in vet school was oriented that way.
Okay. So, what was her background? Did she always want to be a veterinarian as well?
She also had an interest from an early age. Her folks raised pigs growing up, so she had a 4-H and very animal-oriented background as well. So,
Dr. P, thank you again for joining us today on Galesburg Live. We're learning a little bit more about you and your practice. We talked about you and your wife and what your specialties are. Let's talk about the other doctors that are in your practice.
Sure. After Kristen and I were working together for about a year, we hired on Dr. Cassandra Murdoch, and Cassie's from this area. She grew up over by Watauga, so she's a lifelong Galesburg area resident, and she also went to school at the University of Illinois one year after us. So a lot of similarities there.
Yeah.
And Cassie, she really she does a lot of canine medicine as well. Dogs are her favorite thing to
that's her work kind on. Of especially. Yep. Okay, sure.
But she covers a lot of bases for us and does emergency on call for us as well. So the four doctors share and rotate through on call. Right. So we're able to offer that now that there's enough of us to split it up.
So you're not constantly 24/7, but are you? Do you have someone on call 24/7? Is that?
Yeah, somebody is on call 365 days a year.
Wow.
We cover the vast majority of our emergency hours. There are some wee hours of the morning that sometimes we will have the phone turned off, in particular if we've already been working late and have to be in again early.
Sure.
It's important to get a good night's rest in the middle of the very middle of the night. But really, we have not missed very many calls in the last 2 years of being on call. And there comes into play, too, the fact that, you know, if it's a drop-dead emergency at 3 o'clock in the morning, you probably are going to need somebody who can stay there and watch the pet 24/7, and we don't have staff to do that. So in those cases, Tri-County Emergency in Peoria is the best place, you know, for that kind of 24/7 care.
Right.
But the vast majority of the emergencies, thankfully, we're able to accommodate.
So. Wonderful. And the fourth doctor that you have at your practice?
Yes, Dr. Chris Basinger joined us about 2 years ago already. Time's going by quickly.
Yeah.
But Dr. B, as we call Dr. Chris, we usually call her Dr. B.
Dr. B.
She graduated from the University of Minnesota's vet school. But she actually grew up in Galesburg and had moved out to Salt Lake City for a number of years before seeing our job posting a couple of years ago. And she said she really wanted to move back to Galesburg,
sure,
where her mother lives. And so she's been with us now 2 years, and she does a great job. One of her specialties is exotics. So she's well-versed in rabbit and chinchilla medicine and all the small furry creatures. So she sees most of those ferrets as well, hamsters, gerbils, that kind of exotics. And yeah. So that's been really fun to have somebody with special knowledge in that department.
Yeah. Wow. So you cover most of the fur bearing animals. Do you get into the reptiles, snakes, lizards, birds?
We do. We see, and more we're seeing reptiles and amphibians since
right.
Pet Supplies Plus went in across the street.
sure.
That side of things has grown quite a bit, and we're trying to accommodate that, especially Dr. Basinger and I both doing a lot of research on those subjects. You know, those individual species each have their own subset of information. We're trying to keep up the best that we can.
Wow.
You know, we do not claim to be reptile and amphibian specialists. They have those at the University of Illinois, so we do quite a bit of conferring with them and referring over there too. And there are cases that you know are beyond our level of
sure.
expertise with those.
So. What are some of the most common, maybe reptile, snakes, that most common things that people come to you with?
We see a lot of bearded dragons and iguanas, and. The vast majority of the issues with all exotics have to do with husbandry. It is very difficult to make, for instance, the Australian desert in your house. You know, making that environment in your house is very difficult, and so most of their health problems result from deviating from that particular way in which they usually live.
I'll be darned. I also notice on your website, looking at Dr. B's interests, also senior pet care and behavior issues, too, which we're going to talk about with some questions in the next half hour. That's probably a huge area that you're able to help.
Dr. B has rescued a lot of dogs, and a lot of times she rescues dogs which are already seniors. You know, they can be very hard to adopt out.
Sure.
So that's where she ends up with most of her dogs. She really likes Pomeranians. She has a couple of Pomeranians, older Pomeranians. And so she's particularly well-versed in senior care because she's always has senior dogs.
That's right. And you have quite a large staff there with receptionists and technicians and all of that. So you are able to cover such a wide range of animals at your facility.
Yeah, our staff is great. We could not do it without all the support staff. We have a total staff of about 15 people right now, mostly full-time people.
And all animal lovers and all have their certain right animals that they are, they really care about most, yes.
Yes, every one of our staff members definitely has pets. It's sort of a prerequisite in our field.
With that large staff, you've had to do a little bit of renovation recently, from what I understand.
Yes, just a couple months ago, we ended up adding a third exam room and doing new flooring throughout the whole clinic and kennel. And also then the flooring didn't match anymore, so we redid the wall coverings throughout, and that was quite the endeavor. We did everything at night because we're open or available at least 7 days a week, so lots of nighttime work.
So if people haven't been in a while, it's kind of got a facelift there.
Yeah, you'll notice right when you come in that the flooring is different. We got rid of the old linoleum and did vinyl interlock, so it's all nice and
got a great
clean.
Location out there too. It's getting a lot busier with Casey's and Burger King. It's becoming a very popular corner.
Definitely, our corner there has just exploded in terms of business growth and everything else over the last couple of years. I've been amazed at the changes just looking out our window.
One of the things that you wanted to talk about is something that you're seeing more and more in this area in dogs.
Yes, what we were talking about is leptospirosis, which is a bacterial disease that dogs get. Cats can get it as well. It would be your outdoor cats, but most common in dogs, and they get it from ingesting water that would be infected by wildlife. So typically dogs drinking creek, pond, or puddle water, but it could be as simple as, you know, a little puddle of dew in your yard that a raccoon or a possum or a squirrel came by and urinated in that area. It's the urine of all wildlife species can carry this particularly nasty bacteria. Once it gets into the dog's body, it makes its way into the kidneys and liver and does quite a lot of damage, oftentimes before we can even detect that it's there. Typically, dogs get a 1 or 2 degree fever for 24 hours at the very onset of the disease, but most people don't really notice that. It would be hard to say, you know, if your dog's only off for 6 hours or 12 hours because it has a fever, you are not likely to think leptospirosis right off the bat. Usually, we see them for kidney or liver disease, or both liver and kidney disease, once it's progressed into their internal organs. It could be any age of dogs, but it seems like maybe a little bit younger to middle-aged dogs are out and about and drinking that type of water more frequently.
So why do you think it's happening? Why do you think you're seeing more cases of this?
I think that the overall, you know, annual temperature is higher than it has been. And this year is not a very good example because it's been very cold here. We had a cold winter, but previously a lot of our fresh water has not frozen, and so real deep freezes kill that bacteria. So if you look at Lake Story, for instance, it really didn't freeze all the way over for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
This year's the first year there's been ice out there completely. So more shallow types of streams and things that harbor that bacteria are not freezing all the way through, and then the bacteria are able to build up, the wildlife get it, and then transmit it to our pets.
Humans can get this too. I see.
Yes, it is zoonotic, which is a fancy term for a disease that can infect both people and animals.
And it's not always necessarily fatal, right?
No, it's definitely a treatable disease.
Yes.
And it really, the survivability depends on how quickly you catch it.
Yes.
And there are also different strains of lepto, some of which are more aggressive than others. Also, the immune function of the individual animal, you know, comes into play.
Okay.
But there is a good percentage, probably 20% or so, do not make it.
Mm.
You know, the bacteria have done too great a damage to the animal.
So if it's in the water and they can get it from a little puddle, and we know how animals are, okay, dogs and cats are going to drink and eat anything they find. How do we protect our little ones here, our fur babies?
So there's a vaccine out for leptospirosis. There has been for a long time, but the newer vaccines that have come out in the last few years are one way more effective. You know, no vaccine's completely effective, but they're way more effective than the old vaccine, and also less reactive. So one of the problems with the old lepto vaccine was that it could cause allergic types of reactions.
Oh.
It was not very popular, partly because of that, and also because it only had a smaller percentage that would of protection. So of the different strains of lepto, the old vaccine didn't cover all of them. So you know, between that and causing a fair amount of allergic reactions, a lot of people just said, also the relatively lower risk in this area, it was not popular to vaccinate for it until more recently. So we are encouraging vaccines for any dog that may have exposure. One of the kind of difficult things is that the vaccine has to be boosted in 3 to 4 weeks. So it's the first time that they get the vaccine, it's two shots 3 to 4 weeks apart.
I see.
It's once a year after that. So it does require somebody, you know, with an adult dog to come back an extra time for the booster.
I see. But you're seeing, I mean, they're seeing good results from this. So it's protecting them.
Yes, we've yet to see a positive lepto on, you know, a case of infection on a dog who was vaccinated in the recent past.
Okay. So once again, are there any, you may have mentioned this, side effects from the vaccine?
Very limited. The newer vaccine, all vaccines, you know, can have some reaction, but there's no more reaction to that vaccine than say the rabies or distemper parvo that dogs have been getting for years.
I see. And no breed or anything, it doesn't matter what breed, it's no one other is more susceptible than another, size or anything like that, maybe?
No. We've seen lepto in all different sizes of dogs.
Right.
Typically, maybe a little bit more predisposed are the larger dogs because they may go down to creek ponds and puddles.
Sure.
More than the smaller dogs, you know, statistically anyhow. But I've seen teacup chihuahuas that are huge in, you know, their owners go camping. And
sure.
they're as much the rugged outdoorsman as any dog. So
that's right. Now, since we're talking about these spring things that we were going to talk about today, heartworm.
Certainly.
It's getting that time.
Yep. Heartworm season is coming around. So flea, tick, and heartworm season, we sort of collectively refer to it as that, the spring and summer, early fall times. So heartworm is a mosquito-borne disease transmitted mm-hmm. by mosquito bites. So dogs who get, you know, more mosquito exposure have a higher risk of heartworm. And we have been seeing slightly increased amounts of heartworm recently, too.
Again, the weather.
Weather-related. And so our practice, about 80% of dogs are on preventative. There's a once-a-month prevention in the form of Sentinel or HeartGuard. It's a little pill that the dog gets once a month, and that prevents them from getting heartworm, and very effectively so.
Sure. And how do we know that your dog may be infected with heartworm?
There's a blood test. Just take three drops of blood.
Any symptoms or anything that they're – okay.
Sure. So dogs, once they're infected with heartworm, usually it takes 6 to 12 months for them to become clinically ill as the heartworm is growing inside of their heart. And the most common presenting clinical sign is a cough, actually. Causes a cough, and so an exercise intolerance. So that would prompt us to test for heartworm.
And most pet owners, most responsible pet owners, are going to make sure that their animal is on this preventative program.
Yeah, we definitely recommend it. You know, there are some pet owners who decide not to do it, and I respect their decision. You know, there's a lot of pets that never were on prevention and didn't get heartworm, and that's just rolling the dice, you know.
Right.
It doesn't mean it's a great idea. It just didn't happen to that particular dog. So, you know, but particularly if people have been going that way for 30 years, they're right. Maybe decide that that's just how they're going to do it, and we're open to all different, you know, levels of care.
So. But again, very easy, very affordable, and certainly worth it for your family member.
It's come down in price quite a bit, actually. Sure. Sentinel, one brand that we carry, you know, down there somewhere between $3 and $8 a month, depending on the size of your dog.
Sure.
After the rebate. So that's pretty affordable for most people.
Absolutely.
Another upside is that it kills roundworm and whipworm and hookworm as well. So those are intestinal parasites that dogs could very easily get outside. So, important, especially if you have young children that could actually get those diseases from the dog. So that's a side benefit to the heartworm prevention.
Dr. Pete Plesch is our guest this hour on Galesburg Live, and from Animal Medical Center here in Galesburg. And coming up in just a bit, we're going to talk about, we have some questions that we're going to ask him, some to do with older dogs. We have one question that's going to be about a very rowdy dog. I think she refers to him sometimes. He's kind of a jerk, so we'll get into that. But one more item before we take a break, flea and tick season coming up.
Yes, we see dogs on a daily basis for flea problems in the spring, summer, and fall. And there are preventions for that, too. And a lot of people, you know, will say that their dog barely goes outside, so they don't think that there's much risk. But in fact, you can bring it into your house, you know, on your pant leg.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, my gosh.
All it takes is one adult flea, which can lay up to 1,000 eggs a day. Then it doesn't take very long after that to have an infestation.
Wow. And I bet the people that you see, the looks of exasperation on their face or horror or all those.
Yes, it's.
I can only imagine.
It's hard to tell people sometimes that there are insects, in fact, you know, residing in their house on their pet, and they can be actually kind of hard to see. Fleas are afraid of light, and so if you part the hair, fleas run quickly down to the underside of the dog or cat, and then, so it can be hard to see them. And they usually leave dirt, you know, flea poop, basically,
right.
On the base of the hair follicles, but that looks like regular dirt, Oftentimes people are surprised that, in fact, their dog's itching problem and allergy problem has to do mainly with fleas.
Oh, my gosh. And you put them on a regular program. Is that how that works?
Yes. There's, again, a monthly prevention program for that. There's pills or topical or now a collar. There's a once every 8-month collar, which is really safe and works as well or better than anything else, maybe even a little bit better than anything else, just because of a compliance issue there. So once you put the collar on and leave it on, the compliance is 100%.
I had a chance earlier this week to send out an email to my coworkers to see if there are any questions that they had. And a couple of them are about older dogs. And one interesting question came from Michelle, one of our salespeople here at the station. She said, she asked, Dr. Pete, at what age do you recommend giving a dog glucosamine chondroitin?
So glucosamine chondroitin or glucosamine chondroitin MSM, these are all supplements for the joint health. So for trying to prevent and or treat arthritis. Types of diseases in dogs and to some extent in cats.
She said her dog was 12 years old, so that makes a lot of sense.
Yep, mainly a senior issue there. But we start our dogs personally on glucosamine chondroitin supplement at 7 years old. But we do have mainly we have a golden retriever and an English Springer Spaniel. So bigger dogs, sure, more prone to arthritis kinds of issues, which typically start sometime after 7. So kind of as a preventative, we're putting them on at 7, and that's what we recommend. Probably smaller dogs, which are less prone to arthritis due to their weight and size, probably, 8 or 9 years old would be okay. Also very important for joint health to keep your pet in good body condition, so less extra weight carried on the joints just comes into play more and more as they get older, and causes arthritis in and of itself if there's too much weight on those joints.
So better diet, and that means not as many table scraps. Make sure you're getting the right kind of food.
Exactly. No table scraps is the completely okay. correct right. answer there, although right. I think most of us cheat on that once in a while. So.
Right, right. And the more specialty foods, like the, what would you recommend for an older dog?
So for all dogs, we just recommend a premium pet food, and there are lots and lots of them out there. But when I say premium pet food, we just have people typically avoid the grocery store type brands only due to consistency. So the major difference between those two types of food is that the grocery store type of brand, Beneful or something of that of that nature, is going to change. The ingredients are going to change every time that you get a bag, even though the bag is the same and the kibble is the same. They can change the ingredients. That's how they make their their product less expensive.
Sure.
And that's really not harmful for most dogs, but there's a consistency factor there in that if your dog happens to be allergic to one of those things, there can be quite a bit of variation in there. Premium foods tend to have ingredients in there that are more bioavailable, so the dogs can digest them easily and not put as much waste out in the yard from the food. One thing I will mention quickly is that we are not against feeding grain. Is that dogs are actually omnivores, so the designed by nature to eat some grain, so the completely grain free diet's not recommended for most pets, even though they're heavily advertised. There's not a lot of good science right now behind grain free diets for the average dog.
Interesting. Dr. Peter Plesha is our guest today on Galesburg Live. We're reading some questions that I received from our staff members. We got a lot of pet lovers here at the radio station. This one is one of my favorites here. This is from Katie, another one of our salespeople. She says, my dog is a holy terror. Dr. Petey eats everything from his own you-know-what to the house, trailers, pools, medical, electrical covers, cords, rugs, and even my welcome mats. I saw a picture of her welcome mat after her dog got into it. We've tried kenneling him more, running him, medication, you name it. We even fed him a chewable to make his excrement taste bad. Ugh. If it wouldn't already taste bad enough, she says, and he still eats it. And she says, when I say he eats the house, I mean he literally eats the siding off the house. Other than that, he's a really good boy. I'm sure he is. He's 3 years old. He's a red lab. And she said, sometimes he's just a jerk. How do I get him to stop eating me out of house and home? Dr. Pete.
That's a difficult one. Behavior.
It's a lot of behavior issues there.
Yes, behavior type medical issues can cross over and be medical and behavior. Raises the question there of maybe some kind of anxiety disorders, which we do diagnose sometimes in pets that for instance just will tear themselves apart. Even separation anxiety kinds of problems. And sometimes there are medications, anxiety types of drugs that help them be more comfortable. But we tend to use the medications as a last resort. I would recommend behavior types of training first. We refer a lot of behavior types of issues down to Thorne's Pet. Emily Thorne from Thorne's Pet here on Prairie Street in town is well-versed at behavior issues. She's taken, behavior training for dogs to properly train them away from a lot of those problem types of behaviors. And so we've been working with Emily, and she teaches a puppy class in our lobby on Tuesday nights, in fact. So that's really good to get puppies started from the very get-go on good training.
Well, you did say earlier when we were kind of talking about this off the mic that it's that first 6 months that dog is pretty much going to determine he's learning what normal is, right?
Yeah, that's as a rule of thumb, we say the first 6 months kind of dictates what your dog thinks is normal,
yeah.
You know, normal living. So after that, it'd be, you know, similar to trying to teach your teenager table manners. It can be done, but it's going to be more difficult sure. afterwards than in that imprint period. So I really recommend that people, when they get a puppy, you know, try to have some free time in that first six, you know, six and even 12 months to really do a lot of spend extra time training.
Right.
Don't get a puppy probably when you know you're going to have to work 60 hours a week and not have time to do the training right then.
Well, our next question, Dr. Pete, comes from Cameron from our news department. He had a couple questions. One was about an older dog, but this one also was about a younger pet. You hear about socializing your pet at a young age. If a dog isn't ever able to get social time with other dogs, are there negative health effects that can present themselves?
We definitely see more behavior issues in dogs who were not socialized as puppies, and that actually starts with kind of a common question of how early to get a puppy from the breeder, and we're now recommending 10 weeks, and it used to be 6 to 8 weeks. Mm. So as a profession and through research, we've showed that dogs that stay with their puppy mates until 10 weeks have a lower chance of having behavioral issues on down the road when it comes to dog aggression issues. Mm-hmm. And the same goes with exposure in the first 6 months. So, you know, once they're well vaccinated, which is typically at 3 to 4 months, they've had their last parvo vaccine, they're safe to get mixed in with other puppies. And I think if nothing else, our puppy class, you know, the puppy class, that's one really good thing. If you can go to one of those, you know, then they get mixed in with other puppies, and maybe, you know, a 3 pound dog gets to see a 30 pound dog. So they're used to that size difference and other people. And, yeah. And even for our office, it's been good because those puppies come in and they get a treat and they do something fun in our office, which, is not usually the only thing that happens.
That's right. They get a better feeling about going there. They're not so anxious about it. Right. Yeah. We're going to see Dr. Pete. That's right. And finally, we've got one more question. This one is, you know, affects a lot of folks out there, more older dogs. In fact, a couple of my coworkers had this kind of very same question. Crystal, one of our salespeople, said, I have a 13-year-old lab, hard of hearing and bad eyesight. Cameron, our news person, also said, for those of us with older dogs, both of them referred to, it's hard to make that decision when the dog's quality of life has become poor enough. How do you know when enough's enough? I'm sure you get that a lot.
And we do get that question a lot, and it's always a difficult question. Hmm. And so we typically have a discussion about quality of life parameters. You know, what are the things to kind of look for? And the first, you know, question I think people need to ask is, what does your dog normally do? You know, what does he or she enjoy doing? And I'll use my own dog, you know, for an example. So Cedar, you know, he loves to go outside for a walk, and he loves to eat. It's a golden sure. retriever. So, you know, if he gets to where he's 13, 14 years old and he doesn't want to eat, and I get the leash to take him for a walk, and he can't even go, you know, around a half of a block anymore because his joints hurt him so much. I don't think that his quality of life is very good anymore. And that's more of a long-term parameter there too. You know, if he just hurt his leg, you know, and he may get better with some anti-inflammatories in time, then that's right. short-term, but I'm talking more about the long-term.
Sure.
If we're not able to treat his medical problems anymore to where he can have that type of quality of life, you know, then it may be time. So
right.
pain is another parameter. You know, if dog is actively showing that it's having pain. So lack of appetite is one thing to watch for. They're grinding the teeth, called bruxism. It's a sign of pain, whimpering and whining all the time, and an elevated heart rate. That's the other big thing to watch for with pain. Now, a lot of people may have a hard time telling what their dog's heart rate is, but that's one of the things that's come into play for us. We do a fair amount of home visits, you know, so we have a vet box with equipment and things in a vehicle that we go out to people's house so we can see the dog, especially senior patients, in their own home environment and see what's their heart rate when they're resting on the couch, you know. And then end-of-life care, too, we do in the field quite a bit.
That's a wonderful service you guys provide. I mean, and of course, when it does come down to that, they really want them to be in their home where, you know, just like people.
It takes quite a bit of burden off of both the clients and patients quite frequently. And it depends on the dog. Some dogs very happy to come in the clinic, no problems riding in the car, you know, and so it's not a big deal for them to come in. Mm-hmm. But there are quite a few senior patients who it's easier for the people and pets. And we work for a fair number of people, too, with disabilities they can't get in. So,
well, Dr. Pete, I can only imagine that for you and all of your staff, it's got to be one of the toughest parts of what you do.
It's very difficult, that part. You know, it's an emotional time for everybody, and so we are, you know, it's part of what we do, though, and I try to think about it in, you know, with everything else in view, too. You know, you see them as puppies, and the progression is that eventually they become very, very old dogs, and so if you look at it as the whole, you know, life mainly being a good thing, then makes you feel a little better about it.
So. Wonderful. Dr. Pete, thank you so much for joining us today on Galesburg Live.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure. Thanks.